So here's where we are in this economy. Tell me, would you, if you disagree, one step forward, three, maybe four steps back? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, today, the 13th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have come upon, in these strangest of strange days, what might well be the strangest corporate earnings season we are ever going to get. Over the next couple of weeks, we are going to hear from publicly traded companies how they did April through June, or in virus speak, in the worst of the crisis. So far, I guess I should say. And honestly, it's anybody's guess.
There is no crystal ball for this.
That's Andrea Eisfeld. She's an economist at the University of California, Los Angeles.
In a state of heightened uncertainty, usually investors sort of, you know, worry for the worst, but here they're sort of hoping for the best.
In the face, it has to be said, of a lot of evidence, the latest dose of which came this afternoon from California Governor Gavin Newsom, ordering some of the reopening in this state to close. Restaurants, hair salons, gyms, among them.
A lot of the things that we were worried about, like reopening too soon, having to shut down again.
As a lot of epidemiologists and economists were telling us was going to happen. One more thing to remember about all the earnings reports we are going to see the next couple of weeks.
It doesn't take into account anything about the investment spending, you know, that has surely declined precipitously. So even if we have demand returning, we haven't been investing in future growth.
Future growth is going to come. We should be clear about that. It's just a question of when and of how much. Directly related to that, future growth, that is, although I will tell you we didn't plan it this way when we were putting the show together, but directly related to that future growth is this country's mask problem. Science tells us wearing a mask is our best defense. Politics from the White House has tangled that message badly, and it's become more difficult than it should be to get the truth out. So local governments and companies have turned to the magic of marketing and advertising to try to unmix that message. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes a look at whether the fine art of persuasion can get people to mask up.
Back in May, New York launched a competition for ads persuading people to wear masks. There were more than 600 entries. The winner is a riff on the famous I Heart New York slogan.
When we show up in a mask,
we're showing up for each other.
Show your love for New York.
Because New York loves you.
California and Oregon have put out similar public service ads, and the Austin Chamber of Commerce recently started sending this message.
Wear a mask. A mask on each of us is a win for all of us.
Edward Russell, a professor of advertising at Syracuse University, says PSAs like this can work.
Seat belts, don't drink and drive, Smokey the Bear for forest fires, take a bite out of crime.
He says those campaigns changed public perception of certain issues. But masks aren't forest fires, which everyone agrees are bad. The battle over masks has become personal. So Russell says the messaging has to be personal.
The message has to be fast and simple. There has to be something in it for me.
He says facts can be convincing, showing how the virus spreads from one person to the next and how masks can help prevent that. That's the focus of Uber's new TV commercial. The ad shows a series of people's masked faces with text underneath saying, when you wear a mask, you protect Jin. Jin protects Chelsea. Chelsea protects Raphael. The final line, no mask, no ride. Jim Nail is a marketing analyst at Forrester.
Certainly brands do see an opportunity to strengthen that bond between them and their customers.
And between them and their workers, who, in the end, have to enforce the rules and take the heat from customers who don't want to follow them. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday in the land that time forgot. Everything was fine. Good, even, actually, until California put on the economic brakes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know if you saw it, but the New York Times got its hands on some CDC data a couple of weeks ago that showed, among a whole lot of other really troubling realities, that Black and Latino people are three times more likely to contract COVID than their white neighbors are, and twice as likely to die once they do get sick. One of the many reasons for that is that Black and Latino workers are much more likely to have jobs that can't be done from home. Think bus drivers and healthcare attendants, grocery clerks as well. Brownsville in Brooklyn, in New York City, where 80% of residents are Black, has been hit especially hard. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst went and spent some time there.
Father Edward Mason remembers when he realized COVID-19 was going to be devastating to his community in Brownsville. It was back in mid-April. In the local public housing complex, a lot of seniors weren't answering their phones.
And when they went into the building, went into the apartments, they found 10 seniors who had passed away alone in their apartment, predominantly Black with a heavy Latino influence as well.
Since then, the virus has killed dozens of his parishioners.
Two large sectors of employment for our community. For the men, it's grocery stores. And for the women, it's home health aides in the health field, both of which were essential workers who kept working. So you had large segments of our population, most of whom live in apartment buildings, high-density buildings, having to go to work every day.
Audra Palacio, 41, is one of those essential city workers in New York's homeless services. I met with her at her parents' house. Her mom was frying fish for lunch in the kitchen while her dad watched the news. Palacio remembers going to work with people who were getting sick. She asked for guidance from her employers and got none. By late March, she was sick too.
The body aches. It's just like something took over my body and I could not even move. Like it took over my chest. And I had to stop. I could not function. I had to call my supervisor and tell her I can't.
The way Palacio describes it, COVID-19 came into Brownsville like a wildfire. Soon her entire family got it, including her mom and her dad, who is nearing 80. Her next-door neighbor fell into a coma. Her uncle died from it. Palacio says it wasn't just the fact that she got infected, it's the care she received that makes her upset.
I remember going to the health clinic in this neighborhood and being told, if you're feeling sick, why did you come here? You want to get me sick? You want to get other people sick? And we were scolded as an essential worker like myself.
Some essential workers say treatment like that made them feel disposable. Carmen has worked at a hospital in New York for nearly 20 years in close contact with patients. She asked that we not use her last name. She's worried about employer retaliation. We meet on her stoop in Brownsville on a hot summer day, and she points to all the people who died here in the last few months.
We lost the people in the supermarket. We lost people that used to sell food outside. They passed away because they were letting the people die.
She's in her 50s. At the end of March, she asked for some time off since her husband has a heart condition that makes him high risk, and she was being exposed every day.
They didn't approve me to stay home. So I asked for time off. They didn't approve it.
She eventually got sick. She says it was very hard to find testing here. When she finally did, she tested positive. She was told to go home.
I have a big group at church, so we prayed on the phone. We pray twice a day. Ten piedad de nosotros y del mundo entero. Have mercy on us and the whole world.
She eventually recovered from the virus and is back at the hospital now, working. Brownsville is calmer now than it was back in March and April. Neighbors are cleaning up their garage. A big graduation sign hangs on someone's porch. A car bumping music drives by. But many residents here wonder about the second wave of infection and how much New York and this neighborhood can endure. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
You know how same-day deliveries become kind of a thing in this pandemic? Not so much from Amazon, which has been doing it or trying to do it for years, but from companies that leaned in hard once people stopped going to actual stores. Target's a real good example. Catch is, most of the shoppers who pick stuff up from Target stores and get it to you don't work for Target. They are gig workers at a third-party platform, and they are protesting their pay structure this week because instead of setting a rate per order that they get paid, an algorithm takes into account stuff like how busy a store is or maybe how bad street traffic is before figuring out how much people are going to get paid. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on how algorithms are increasingly ruling gig workers' livelihoods.
Most users are familiar with surge pricing, where prices vary depending on demand. But that's just part of a complex web of algorithms that affect everything from which jobs a gig worker is offered to how much they get paid for them.
I really compare it to like the wizard behind the curtain and Wizard of Oz.
Carlos Ramos has been a rideshare driver in San Diego for 3 years.
Stuff is happening back there and like you have no idea what's going on.
He's noticed some patterns, like he first logs on and he's offered a lot of shorter, less lucrative rides, until he decides to call it a day and head home.
And I'll get a request, and it's a 100-mile trip in the other direction. This has happened time and time again.
He thinks it's because of Lyft's algorithm, but he can't be sure because companies keep their software secret.
We have no idea. Everything that we know about the algorithms is based on what workers tell us they experience.
Vina Dubel is a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. She's surveyed hundreds of gig workers to tease out how the algorithms work. And she's concluded they're designed to keep workers logged on for as little pay as possible.
They, therefore, cannot predict their income on any given day or in any given shift.
These systems cause financial uncertainty that puts workers at a disadvantage, says Kate Crawford, the co-founder of the AI Now Institute at NYU.
These algorithmic systems are essentially increasing the power asymmetry between workers and employers to quite an extreme degree.
She says while each platform has its own unique algorithms, they all have a common objective: to maximize profits, often at the expense of workers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we started getting more goods in, but that's when our regular business started slowing down.
The perils of misaligned supply and demand. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, kind of was a wash today, basically, except for one. I'll tell you about it. Dow Industrial's up 10, basically flat, 26,085. The NASDAQ down 226 points, 2.1%, 10,390. The S&P 500 down about 0.9%. 31 and 55 there. Kristen was looking at the value of campaigns to encourage mask wearing. So how many people are wearing them now? Well, here is what Pew Research found. In a June survey, about 65% of U.S. adults said they had worn a mask in stores or other businesses all or most of the time. About 15% said some of the time. 9% said they hardly ever wear a mask. Wear a mask. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Crude oil, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, to be precise, closed down 1% and 1/10 today, just a hair over $40 a barrel. It's a long way from the negative tumble we saw that day back in late April, if you remember that, but also a long way from where energy companies can make a profit. And so those companies are trying to cut costs, which means that if you run a business tied to oil and gas, like, for instance, one that sells sand to drilling companies to use in fracking, you are not in a good way. Three frac sand companies have filed for bankruptcy since June. So Marketplace's Andy Euler looked into how the faltering sand industry is hitting the small towns sustained by those sand mines.
Sand is an important component of fracking. Producers mix it with water to blast oil and gas from shale. Sand kept Marcelo Maldonado quite busy for 4 years at C&J Energy in Houston. He says when oil was selling at $120 a barrel a few years ago, he was buying sand from Wisconsin and shipping it down to Texas.
The standard was to bring it from up north, use the rail to put it closer to the wells.
They've been mining sand in Wisconsin for 100 years, but fracking caused a boom. Thomas Pearson at the University of Wisconsin-Stout wrote a book about it.
Many of the mining companies, you know, they assured residents that this was an industry that was here to stay. Those promises were shown to be false.
Because when oil was trading below $30 a barrel in 2016, many sand mines shut down. And to save money, oil companies started buying sand closer to the wells. Marcelo Maldonado says one town in West Texas, Kermit, reaped the benefits.
We saw a boom. A spike in job demands. A lot of people had to get hired to operate those plants.
He says that lasted for a couple of years, and then COVID-19 hit and oil prices tanked. Michael Weber at the University of Texas at Austin says when energy companies and sand miners propose setting up in rural towns, local leaders often jump at the prospect of adding jobs and tax revenue. But there are always consequences.
I think that's always the tension is how do you get the economic development without the volatility? Because the volatility is really difficult for planners and for people.
The latest frac sand company to seek Chapter 11 protection is Houston-based Hi-Crush, which operates mines in small towns around the country, including in Wisconsin and Minnesota. The company has cut 60% of its workforce since mid-March. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A little bit more than a week ago, President Trump signed an extension of the Paycheck Protection Program into law. It moved the application deadline out to August the 8th because, at least in part, the Small Business Administration says there's still something more than $100 billion left in that program. In all so far, there have been almost 4.9 million loans made under the PPP. Here is how some of those loans have played out in one place.
I'm Lori Stewart, and I'm the president and CEO of Sound Community Bank, which is headquartered in Seattle, Washington.
We have talked to Lori Stewart a couple of times since Sound Community Bank became one of the 5,400 lenders in the program.
Near the end of June, we had made 800 loans, and they totaled over $72 million. We've saved thousands of jobs.
Jobs like?
Quite a few coaches,
licensed architects,
veterinary assistants,
operational staff who maintain the pool,
customer service representatives or doing some reception work.
And then we also have lifeguards.
That's Stephen Freigang. He's at Wave Aquatics, a nonprofit in Redmond, Washington that does swim lessons and water polo, that kind of thing. Bradley Corey, also the founder of an architecture and design firm in Seattle called B9 Architects. And Mark Donovan. He's a senior partner at Seattle Veterinary Associates. All three of them got PPP loans through
Sound Community Bank,
the bank that Lori Stewart runs. Loans that help the three of them combined keep 235 people on their payrolls. Here's Stephen Freigang from Wave Aquatics again.
If we had not gotten the loan, we would have had to lay people off probably on a permanent basis. Today, we do have everyone on payroll who elected to return.
Meanwhile, Bradley Corey over at B9 Architects had some projects postponed, some disappear altogether.
I was concerned how I would support my staff and how I could maintain stability for them. And so with the loan, we've been paying primarily staff salaries.
Same story for Mark Donovan and his partners at Seattle Veterinary Associates.
If we had not successfully received a PPP loan, it would have been extremely challenging, if not impossible, for us to keep that workforce intact.
According to the Census Bureau's most recent survey of small businesses, 75% of small businesses tried to get PPP loans. More than 72% of them got those loans. Tess Thomas, though, was not in that number. She owns Emma's Barbecue in South Seattle.
Sometimes when you don't have that A1, A+ credit rating, it works against you. And it can work doubly hard against African-American people. I've not always been so fortunate in the financial area of being able to put those things together, and especially so during the COVID.
She said she looked into getting a PPP loan, started the application process with her bank, but looking at her credit score and all the documentation they were asking for.
Finally, I just gave up even trying. Those are things that were barriers, and I know that I'm not the only one that has gone through this in African-American businesses here in this community.
So she's cut hours for her staff. She's only opening her restaurant 3 days a week now, and she's trying to hang on till the economy and also the virus, which is kind of the same thing, turn around. It ought to be remembered that for all the grim virus and attendant economic news here, this is a global crisis. And one of the things that's been disrupted is global trade. And that, in turn, brings us to our latest edition of
What's Up?
What's Up?
What's Up, World?
What's Up, World? Today, the traded commodity of choice is textiles and apparel. According to the latest data from the Department of Commerce, the total value of U.S. textile and apparel imports in May this year was down 25% from a year earlier. That is, of course, in the aggregate. You break it down by region and country, and it becomes a lot more tangible. Textile imports from Honduras down 42% from May last year, which is not good for companies that depend on the American market. Eric Ju is the general director of United Textiles of America based in Coloma, Honduras. Eric, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So first things first, I suppose, what has pandemic life been like in that economy down there? I mean, is there a lockdown? Are you out and about? Can you do business?
It's been challenging, to say the least. The government has put a lockdown in place, and they've been dealing with varying degrees of openness and balance, I guess, the health of its citizens along with the needs of the economy. At first, they implemented a broad lockdown across the spectrum and shut down the entire economy, but then they lifted it in piece by piece and allowed essential industries to start operating. With United Textiles, we manufacture raw materials for personal protective equipment, which right. Is considered an essential industry.
Can we talk supply chain here for a minute? Where do you get your raw materials, and has that been impacted by this whole thing?
Yeah, we bring in most of our raw materials from Asia, and we're in the polyester business, and China really dominates the polyester industry. China and the country alone manufactures more polyester than the rest of the world combined at this time. And initially, when COVID-19 started happening, China was on lockdown, so we weren't able to get our goods in. And the rest of the industry around us was asking us to hurry up and keep delivering as the retailers and brands in the United States started panicking, trying to keep the flow of goods going. And then after China started recuperating, we started getting more goods in, but that's when our regular business started slowing down.
As you look around at your plant, do you have worries that you're going to have to lay people off? Are you going to be able to keep hiring people? I mean, is it a day-to-day thing now? I suppose it is, right?
It is very much a day-to-day thing. We actually had a surge where we hired quite a few temporary employees. The U.S. Government, through the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, yeah. they placed large orders for hospital gowns and face masks, which really buoyed the industry here. Since then, that program has sunsetted, and they've transferred it over to the Defense Logistics Agency, the DLA, part of the Department of Defense. And there's new bids going out, but things are very uncertain. I think that both agencies have been overwhelmed by the newness and the complexity of dealing with so much need and disparate supply chains.
Yeah, this is going to sound like a naive observation, but it's kind of wild to think of something like FEMA and their decisions reaching a textile factory in Honduras, you know, just as a layperson.
Yes, I mean, we're still living in a very globalized economy, and, you know, some small decisions by one government official can have global repercussions. It's a very interesting world we live in today.
Yes, it is. What's the mood? I mean, what's the general vibe on the streets when you talk to your workers or when you go out and, I don't know, just try to get some fresh air or something?
There's certainly a lot of fear about COVID, but here at United Textiles, we're very thankful that we still have work to do. Yeah. We're hoping that some additional business will come out of the DLA programs. We're hoping that it'll keep things going because people are having difficulty feeding their families down here. A lot of the economy is still shut down. So I do expect that if things don't go well with the larger economy here, we'll see some more people trying to illegally migrate up to the United States again.
Well, Eric, thanks a lot. Eric Ju is general director of United Textiles of America. We got him in or near, I guess, his factory down in Honduras. Eric, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, it's a quickie because we're a little bit tight. The Treasury Department released numbers on the federal deficit for June this morning. We spent $864 billion more than we took in a month. 30 days. The policy case to be made for it, of course, is that without all of that deficit spending to deal with virus-related economic dislocation, things would be orders of magnitude worse right now. All right, we got to go, but not without another nugget from that deficit report. Here you go. The federal deficit for the first 9 months of the fiscal year, $2.7 trillion. All right, we're going. Our daily production team is Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.